Welcome. In an earlier lecture, we discussed the techniques of the observer developed by the German pietists living in the 12th and 13th century Jewish communities of the Rhine Valley, perhaps putting them down to paper for the first time, or having no clear idea as to how far back in history these techniques and ideas may have existed orally, being passed down secretly from master to teacher. In one of the texts that we read, we heard how ambivalent and reluctant the author was to put down in writing the secrets which shouldn't be revealed to everybody. But these techniques of the observer, these ways of neutralizing the fascination that obvious physical appearance has on us in order to gain insight and discover God's presence, the underlying unity of the world, in discovering these techniques, we understood what the German Hasidim were all about. They observed the world and they discovered the divine unity behind all appearances. There's a useful distinction made by a professor of philosophy who was interested in mysticism, Walter Staes, who makes a distinction between two families or two styles of mysticism. He calls one extroverted mysticism and the other introverted mysticism. The German Hasidim that we talked about in an earlier lecture are a wonderful example of extroverted mystics. The world is left intact. The mystic or the pietist still remains a human being, a person with a distinct point of view, still remains an observer. It's extroverted in the sense that it turns to the outside world and discovers its underlying spiritual unity. The insight is beneath the surface, but the surface is nonetheless there, as palpable and as tangible and as commanding a presence as the Gothic cathedral would be to a Christian, and as tangible and as monumental and as present as the text of the Bible or of the prayers of rabbinic tradition would be to the Jew. That is extroverted mysticism, a technique for altering the modes of perception that leaves the world intact, the mystic intact, but making apparent the underlying spiritual unity. Staes's second category, introverted mysticism, is taking extroverted mysticism one step further. What the German Hasidim did with their techniques, to texts, to physical reality, to history, to religious experience of revelations, the introverted mystic does to the soul of his own self. He escapes the world. The world dissolves. His own integrity, his own identity disappears. Parenthetically, I'm using the word he quite consciously, because there's very little evidence that in Jewish tradition, which excluded women by and large from the seats of power and learning, there were no Jewish mystics that we know about who were women in the early centuries, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th. So I'm using the pronoun he quite deliberately. The introverted mystic, he, would adopt the same techniques of observation developed by the German Hasidim in the 12th and 13th century, perhaps reaching back to techniques that had been developed in Jewish life earlier, and turn them not on the text of the Bible, but on the text of the human personality itself. Ordinary consciousness, the sense of my being an ego, a distinct being, would dissolve. The unity that the German Hasidim perceived in the outside world would become a goal of unification. The mystic would become that unity. The distinction between object and subject would disappear, evaporate, and all that would be left would be a sense of the identity of myself with the divine and the world. I've used three different words to describe three different things, but to the introverted mystic, all of those distinctions dissolve. Or to use an analogy taken from another tradition, consciousness would be like a grain of salt dissolved in a great ocean, hardly distinct from all of the other particles floating in that saline solution. The mystic who is most responsible for introducing this introverted mystical consciousness into Jewish life is a 13th century Jewish mystic by the name of Abraham Abulafia, who is credited with founding this introverted, prophetic, ecstatic form of Jewish mysticism proper. As I said earlier in the lectures, mysticism proper, Kabbalah, cannot be said to have existed in the ancient Near Eastern biblical period. It certainly didn't exist in the Greco-Roman rabbinic period, despite all of the ecstatic trips taken to heaven. And strictly speaking, it didn't exist in the German Hasidim, which I described in an earlier lecture. They laid down the foundations, the components, for what would evolve into Jewish mysticism or Kabbalah proper. And Abulafia would be the one who would develop one of the two main threads of the Kabbalistic tradition in the Middle Ages, this introverted form of Kabbalah. According to Professor Moshe Edel of the Hebrew University, who has made emphatic the difference between Abulafia's form of Kabbalah and the other forms which we'll examine in later literature, the prophetic, ecstatic, introverted mysticism of Abulafia is radically different typologically, phenomenologically, than all other forms of Jewish mysticism or spirituality. It's not built in the same way as the hand and glove of most other Jewish mysticisms, fitting over the practices and beliefs of normal Judaism. It's a set of complementary techniques which overlap and which add to and supplement normal Jewish life. The other Jewish mystics that we'll discuss later don't develop brand new techniques. They transform the meaning of the old rituals. So Abulafia doesn't charge old Jewish rituals with new meaning, but he develops new techniques. The other main difference between Abulafia's introverted mysticism and all others is in its radical anthropocentrism. It's extraordinarily and almost exclusively interested in the secrets of the human soul, in the modes of perception and in consciousness. It's not interested in interpreting or understanding the world outside. It is only interested in examining the processes by which consciousness, perception, thought, memory, imagination, rationality comprise the human being in his ordinary mode of being, and which prevent the ordinary human being from perceiving the mystery of his own self and its linkage or identity with the divine unity everywhere. The other forms of Jewish mysticism of Kabbalah which developed were less anthropocentric and more theocentric, as Professor Edel emphasizes, much more interested in understanding God's nature and God's relationship to the world, and how God's creation is at the same time God's self-revelation. Abulafia and his disciples are less interested in that. They're less interested in the divine, in its activity, but much more interested in emphasizing the identity between reformed, transformed human consciousness and the divine mind. How would ordinary consciousness be transformed into an instrument by which the identity of the human operations could be shown to be identical with those of the divine mind? Ordinary consciousness won't do. Something else is necessary. A set of techniques necessary, parallel to the techniques that the German Hasidim needed to develop in order to see through the obvious meaning of the biblical texts and Jewish patterns of ritual performance to discover their underlying spiritual unity. Something that would neutralize the ordinary way we think, imagine, and remember, that would allow us to pick up the signals being transmitted everywhere around us of the divine mind. Techniques turned against the self in order to elevate the self into its true being. Abulafia apparently studied deeply the works of a Jewish philosopher, Maimonides, who lived 1135 to 1204, and in whose magnum opus, central work of religious thought, The Guide for the Perplexed, developed a philosophic theory of prophecy which inspired Abulafia. According to Maimonides, an ordinary philosophic understanding of the human consciousness, there are three main levels of operation, three ways in which we come to understand the world. The first is immediate sense experience, mediated by our five senses, touch, smell, hearing, etc. Our bodies collect, like clerks collecting data, input from the outside world, and pool them together in a great collecting basin of sensory experience. There, higher order clerks take the work that's done by the senses, pool the input, aggregate them, collect them, categorize them, and preserve them in memory. After the sensory input has been collected and classified and pooled in memory, a second level of operation begins to work on sensory input, and that level is called imagination. Imagination takes the building blocks of sensory input and comes up with creatures and things unseen and undreamt of in our philosophies. Imagination can take the head of an elephant, which we saw with our own eyes, and the appearance of a human body, which we've seen with our own eyes, and fuse them together into a new creature with the head of an elephant and the body of a man. Imagination does not have to conform to reality. That's the good news about imagination, and it's bad news. It can conjure for us things which don't actually exist out of the raw materials of the world which we do exist, leading us astray sometimes into imagining what really isn't there. That's the dangerous operation of imagination. But there's a better operation too. Imagination is what allows the human consciousness to take all of the eyes which it's ever received, all of the sounds that it's ever received, and pool them together and imaginatively create the notion of an arm in general. Not any one particular arm, but the notion or the image, the imaginative image of an arm or an elephant or a tree, a sort of aggregate summary of all the distinct particular ones which we've actually experienced, and put it together into an abstract general notion or image of a thing or of an idea. It doesn't have to be something as particular as a tree. It could be a triangle. A triangle is a concept developed in the imagination of all things that exist that have three sides. Nowhere in the world would we ever find an exact perfect triangle except in imagination. So from the lowest level of particular, concrete, specific things pooled in memory, imagination raises sensory experience into a higher, as it were, more abstract level, but nonetheless having one foot very deeply rooted in the particularity of sensory experience. Then, according to the medieval psychology developed by Maimonides and other philosophers in the Islamic and Jewish traditions, after imagination has done to sensory experience what it does, there's a third, higher operation called intellect. And what intellect does is to take the imaginative forms which we've created and abstract them from reality even further, developing not the image of something with particular colors or shapes, but something extraordinarily abstract, far removed, all-inclusive, universal, like the concept of a geometric body, not a triangle in particular, but what all sorts of geometric things would have, whether they be circles or triangles or squares. All of these objects would have certain properties in general. It would be very universal, very abstract. These would be ideas. And the way we would get our ideas would be from this upward path of sensory experience being transformed in imagination, and from imagination up into intellect. And if there is any part of our consciousness which comes as close as possible to understanding what God might be like, on the same idea that the German Hasidim had, that God must be pure spirit, it must be intellect which comes as close as possible to telling us what the divine nature might be. Something akin to our intellect at its best operation. And if not God in his entirety, then at least God's mind. And in the way this was understood in the Middle Ages, God's mind creates the universe in the exact opposite by which we come to abstract universal knowledge. We begin with sensory particular forms, sounds, shapes, colors, objects existing in physical reality, and then move them to ever more increasing spiritual, universal, abstract notions. And in the mind of God, things work exactly the opposite. Creation would reverse the process. God's mind would begin with a perfect idea of something, and then it would descend at various levels to more and more particular, concrete, specific objects. It's as if you can imagine something even more abstract than Einstein's general theory of relativity, the one principle that would explain all of reality, something which transcends even the equivalence of energy, mass, and the speed of light. Even that is too complex, too multiple for God's mind. In the medieval view, there's some principle higher than energy, something even higher than mass, something even greater than the speed of light, which would be the idea in God's mind. From that one simple idea, the one unified idea of all ideas, there would be a process of degeneration, as it were, as things move from their more abstract, their more perfect spiritual existence in God's mind, down into the various things and classes of objects which exist in our world. According to Maimonides, when God wanted to reveal himself to a prophet, it presupposed that that prophet was able to communicate with God, but the only part of the prophet which would be able to communicate would be the most perfected part, the most abstracted part of God, of the human being, intellect. So in the Maimonidean view of prophets, God chose only those people who had the mental capacity for understanding purely abstract, divine-like ideas. Unlike philosophers or scientists, who also would be equipped to understanding the ideas in God's mind, which undergird and underwrite reality, the prophet would be able to take those abstract ideas and transform them into the imagination, where they would take color, shape, and personality. Abstract ideas would be made vivid and particular in order to communicate them to people who were not as perfected. Therefore, in the medieval view, the prophet was the one who had the most perfect, accomplished, trained intellect, and the most perfect and trained and accomplished imagination. The one who would be able to take ideas from God's mind and translate them into the kind of images, verbal and visual, that ordinary human beings would need to know in order to conduct their lives in accordance with God's truth. That would be the upward way of human knowledge, sensation, memory, imagination, intellect, and the downward way of prophecy, whereby God's mind would send ideas into the mind of the prophet, who would then translate these ideas into lower forms of the imagination and into sensation, translating abstractions about God's being into such particular things as the commandment not to wear garments made with linen and wool together, or the notion that on the holiday of Passover, that last 7 days, one shouldn't eat leavened bread. That's what prophet lawgivers like Moses could do, according to Maimonides. Abulafia apparently studied these Maimonidean ideas and this psychology deeply and profoundly, and absorbed their lessons about this hierarchy of human operations. Sensation being the lowest form, imagination being the next step up, and intellect being the most supreme form of all. The trick would therefore be to neutralize the ordinary way in which we perceive the world through sensation and move up to intellect by canceling all of that out and by operating on a mind-to-mind basis. In order to do that, in order to suspend the ordinary way of thinking and of imagining and of sensing, Abulafia developed a series of techniques that would throw a monkey wrench into ordinary consciousness. Ordinary consciousness is our habitual way of looking at the world. And the other thing that Abulafia would have learned from Maimonides and the other medieval philosophers was that intellect really didn't appear at the final stage. Intellect was there working all along, if only we were aware of it. Intellect shows its presence when, if we see a small little green thing, we immediately guess that this little green thing is a leaf, and from there we conjure up, hypothesize, intuit, that there must be a tree or a bush. And if we can see the shape of the leaf, we can even guess what sort of thing it is. That must indicate, according to the medieval thinkers, that even at the very beginning, our preconceived ideas affect the way we sense the world. There is no raw sensory experience. From the very beginning, intellect and the higher operations have been guiding us by setting up expectations, and we only fill in the blanks. Having learned this lesson, Abulafia decided, or discovered, through trial and error and from listening to a lot of people and watching all sorts of people experiment with their consciousness, how to alter those pre-existing ideas which already tell us what we're going to see. It's that phenomenon of proofreading your own writing and skipping over the typos, because the mind's eye knows what must be there and tells the eye what it should see. The mind, if it was in charge, would always pick up the typos if the mind in charge knew what the truth was. And so Abulafia would develop a set of techniques that in the very beginning would organize and corral ordinary consciousness by amplifying the correct ideas in intellect, stopping the mind from getting fascinated and fixated at sensation and imagination, and of going straight to the intellectual operation. Not very easy to do. Ordinarily, our consciousness is hierarchic, sensation, imagination, thinking. Ordinarily, we are told what to think before we even experience it. And the other thing which is true about our minds is that they are chaotic. To use the analogy used in other traditions, our ordinary minds are like monkeys, cavorting and jumping in the trees, going from place to place, disorganized, chaotic, unable to concentrate and focus on the truth. How can we tame the monkey of consciousness? How can we throw a monkey wrench into the ordinary ways that our minds and souls work in order to see the world as it really is and to discover who we really are? Abulafia developed a set of techniques for doing precisely that. Let me give you some examples of how the technique would work. According to the recipes, one is to practice corral consciousness and ordinary thinking by subjecting it to a very rigorous discipline, getting into the mind and manipulating the way our minds are controlled by our thoughts and our consciousness, by our socialization, and to neutralize it or to interrupt its automatic response. Language, ordinary language, is the enemy, and it needs to be overcome in order to keep the monkey of consciousness corralled and disciplined. And so, Abulafia himself and his disciples gave the following sorts of exercises, meditations, to be done in order to dehabituate ordinary thinking and to develop pure consciousness. The first exercise, take any word you want, write it down, and then, like a child's game, rearrange the letters. Make as many permutations of those rearranged letters as you want. It doesn't make any difference whether the words make sense and are found in the dictionary or not. Take a word like time, T-I-M-E, and then on a piece of paper, write out all of the possibilities. Time, T-I-M-E, emit, E-M-I-T, might, M-I-T-E, item, I-T-E-M, medi, M-E-T-I. Some of the words exist in the dictionary, some of them don't. It doesn't make any difference. Just let the mind play the game and rearrange letters. And when you've run out of all the permutations of a 3- or 4-letter word or a 5-letter word, start all over. A new word, read, R-E-A-D. Of course, Abulafia would be doing this with the Hebrew language and not with English, although he also played with all the other languages that he knew, Greek, Italian, etc. In English, read, R-E-A-D, permutate it, dear, D-E-A-R, dare, D-A-R-E, raid, R-A-D-E, erd, E-R-D. Your mind might look at the word E-R-A-D, erd, and say that doesn't exist in the English language, but it sounds an awful lot like the German erd, which also means earth. And the mind would want to go off by making the association into German. That would be the ordinary thing to do, but the rule of the game is no, stop. Start with another word, grades, G-R-A-D-E-S. Permutate it into as many words as you can. It turns into, you can get 2 words out of that one, red gas, for example, or D-rags, or as dreg, or Edgar's, ad infinitum. Play that game for a long, long time with pencil and paper. When you become very adept at this game, Abulafia said, dispense with pencil and paper and do it only orally, out loud. Move away from the physical pen and paper and just use your mind and mouth and sound. And when you've done that for a few months and you've got all of that down, then move to the third level. As the second level was less physical than the first, no more pencil and paper, and merely sound, the third level is even more abstract. Don't write it, don't even pronounce it. Just play the anagram game in your head. Imagine, silently, a word, and then rearrange it as best as you can, and do it until you become quite adept. That's basic exercise number one. Basic exercise number two, take any word in the Hebrew alphabet, in the Hebrew language. Take a word from the Bible, if you will. Define its gematria, that technique that we learned from the German Hasidim. Ignore what the word means. Find out what its numerical value is, as if it were a code. And then write down as many words as you can think of that have the same gematria, the same numerical meaning. And do that for as long as you possibly can. And when you become adept at finding the numerical values of words and phrases and linking them together, not allowing the mind to construct syntactically significant sentences, but by forcing the mind to associate words by reducing them to numbers and then making words and phrases relate to each other numerically that have no cognitive dictionary meaning. When you've got that technique of gematria mastered, then do it orally. No more pencil and paper to figure out what letters mean and what their additions are. Do it orally until you become quite adept. And then after you've become adept at that secondary level of technique, then do it as you did with the first game, purely mentally. Find a phrase in the Bible. Determine its gematria, its numerical value. And then in your head, come up with as many phrases and words. Whether they mean something or not doesn't make any difference. And play that game for as long as you can. The games get, the meditation techniques, get more and more complicated. Combinations of the gematria equivalences with the rearrangements of letters. Taking the initial letters of words that you generate and creating new ones and starting new chains. And again and again and again with each of these ever more increasing complex meditational techniques based on the word. Practice it until you become adept in writing. Then do it vocally. And when you finish doing it vocally, then do it only in your head. And as a result, you become more and more disciplined. The mind is less apt to go off in its usual logical patterns, and it begins gets accustomed to making abstract, extraordinarily abstract, links of associations between one thing and another. I promise you that if you try these techniques, you'll see that they will indeed have an effect on your ordinary consciousness. They really do. It works. And then Abulafia and his disciples said, after you have really mastered these three levels of techniques, the writing forms, the oral forms, and the merely meditative ones, with words taken from the Hebrew language, then you may begin tackling the truly difficult words of all, the words which are the name of God. And you're to do it under very well-defined circumstances. And this is what a 16th century text called the Ladder of Ascent describes as the circumstances under which one attempts this final, most complicated set of techniques. First, adorn yourself in your best clothing and seclude yourself in a special place where your voice will not be heard by anyone. And I emphasize here this individual, private, meditative technique. Traditional Jewish worship is done in community, in synagogue, or in the family. But here is Abulafia counseling people to detach themselves from their community and to go off alone, dressing well, in a place where one's voice will not be heard, in isolation. Purify your heart and soul and your thoughts from all considerations dealing with this world. Don't attend to your immediate circumstances. How far this has come from Rabbinic Judaism, which insists that people take full attention of the world around them. For Abulafia, no. Purify your heart, soul, and your thoughts from all considerations concerning this world. Think that at that very hour, your soul is separating from your body, and that you are dying away from this world, and that you are living in the supernal world, in the divine world, which is the source of all life. You're no longer a denizen, an inhabitant of this planet, of your body. Ordinary consciousness and experience no longer fascinates you. Think of yourself as belonging to the supernal world, the world of God's mind. namely, that simple, unified, spiritual intellect of which all people fear, the fear of highness and glory, and the fear of love. And when your knowledge and your intellect is about to cleave, to join, to adhere, to identify, to attach with, to dissolve into, when your knowledge and your intellect, which has been purified by all these months and years of meditation technique, are about to cleave unto the divine knowledge, which provides you with knowledge and intellect, then your mind must remove from itself the yoke of all knowledge concerning all matters other than his knowledge, the divine knowledge, which is commonly shared with you and him by means of his glorious and awesome name. At the pinnacle of this experience of isolated meditation, one senses the destruction, the dissolution of ordinary consciousness, and the identity of the divine mind with the human mind, the reversal of Maimonidean prophetology, who begins with mind and ends up with sense and imaginative things. In Abulafia, these sensory techniques, these meditation techniques, lift you to the realm of pure mind, and at that point, one attaches. Devekut is the Hebrew word used. Adheres to, like glued surfaces coming together, the human mind and the divine mind become one. That's the ultimate frame of mind, but how does one do it? After months and months and years of practice, and in this setting, and with this set of intentions, one practices taking God's name and linking it with the different vowels of the Hebrew alphabet. For example, one takes two letters of God's names, let's say the Y and the H of Yahweh, and permutates each of these letters with vowels of the Hebrew alphabet. And if one did that, one would come up with a series of nonsensical words, which are the combined elements of God's name, that would sound something like this. O Yo, O Ya, O Yi, O You. And then the reverse. Yo O, Yo Ah, Yo A, Yo E, Yo U. Next vowel, Ah. I Ya, I Ye, I Yi, I You, I Yo. Reversed. Ya-ah, ya-e, ya-e, ya-u, ya-o, and so forth for each of the vowels and letters of the divine name. By this time, the mystic is not worried that he's pronouncing words and syllables that don't seem to have any apparent meaning. Because after years and years of practice in the technique, the mind has already become familiar with the various combinations of letters which lead to identities between things which ordinary consciousness would never see, and which leads to a transcendent realm in which ordinary thinking and discursive logic no longer operate. And it's not just to be pronounced, but it's a form of yoga, because according to Abulafia, as one pronounces these syllable combinations of God's names, one coordinates the breath, just as we find in many mystical traditions. One breathes in coordination with each of these patterns. One breath for each line, not more, not less. And just as a Zen Buddhist monk who wants enlightenment will be instructed to count breaths, to sit for years counting breaths to 10 and then going back to 1 again, an Abulafian mystic learns to coordinate, corral, discipline breath with the pronunciation of the letters of God's name. And we already know from the German Hasidim, who learned it from the rabbinic sources themselves, that words and language count. They count for everything. It's just that Abulafia is turning these techniques on himself rather than on anything else. But the Abulafian techniques don't stop at breathing and at pronouncing the magical names of God in order to achieve identity of the mind, one also performs a different kind of yoga, not just breathing. You adopt bodily postures, and you coordinate the bodily postures with the vowels that one is saying. In Hebrew, the Hebrew vowel for ah is a straight line underneath a letter, going from left to right. And when you pronounce that vowel in the line, aya, aye, ayu, ayo, each time you pronounce the ah coordinated with your breath, according to the Abulafian tradition, your head is to imitate what the scribe does, and instead of moving the pencil on the paper under the letter from right to left, you move your head from right to left as you say the vowel ah. As you say the vowel o, which is a dot above the letter, the instructions are to raise your head on high as if it were the vowel. And if it's a letter, a vowel beneath the letter, you bow your head. And so a good Abulafian technique, after months and months and years of practice of those basic fundamental games of anagrams and gematria, is a coordinated set of breathing techniques and bodily postures and secret combinations of God's name, which will then induce you into that state of mind, which the text described as divekut, or identity or attachment between your mind and the divine mind. There are no more thoughts of the world. The texts instruct you to believe that you have died to the world, that your body has gone away, that your soul has gone to the divine realm. Unlike rabbinic Judaism, not in ordinary everyday consciousness, certainly unlike those rabbinic texts that talk about heavenly ascent, and more like the German Hasidim who said, understand the verses properly and you will find the divine unity, Abulafia turns the techniques of the observer against ordinary mind, coordinating breath with bodily posture, having diffused the mind's fascination with ordinary language, which preconditions the way we experience reality. Ordinary life disappears. All that's left is the mind, which has been indulging and luxuriating and concentrating in a focused, coordinated, cosmicized way, the very structures of reality. Does the human mind dissolve as a human mind and discover all along that it is the divine mind identically? To use the analogy given in other literatures, in yogic literature, the goal is to untie the knots that bind the soul. And once the knots that bind the soul are loosened, the soul can become itself and recognize itself as being one and the same as the object that it's thinking about. From the philosophers, Abulafia had learned that God is understood as three dimensions which are one. There is the process of thinking, there is the thought itself, and that which thinks, which in God are all three one and the same. Seichel, maskil, muskal. The goal will be to liken the human mind to what the divine mind is, when one senses that thought, the process of thought, and that which is the object of thought are all one and the same. And if everything is all one and the same, then there is only one reality, and it is the divine name of which individual consciousness is a part, an illusion that it thinks itself apart from it, in truth, one and the same. That is introverted mysticism. That is anthropocentric, Abulafian, ecstatic, prophetic Kabbalah. At the end, when consciousness has been transformed, consciousness discovers itself as identical with the divine mind. Thank you.